and following the purchase of a steam-powered press, Löwenthal's print run had expanded to 200. Now, in January 1866, he was printing nearly 1,000 copies of every edition, and he had hired a staff of 2. In order to advertise to his subscribers that the Times had been Hokitika's very first daily gazette, Löwenthal set the first edition of the paper behind glass and hung it in his front office. He therefore remembered the exact date of the newspaper's establishment, the 29th day of May 1865, for he saw this framed edition every morning. The man in question, Löwenthal explained, had certainly arrived at some point in June, for Löwenthal's steam-powered press had been delivered on the first day of July, and he distinctly remembered processing the scarred man's advertisement on his old hand-powered machine. How was it that his memory was so distinct upon this point? Well, upon setting the type, Löwenthal had discovered that 2 inches square, the standard size for a column advertisement, and the size for which the scarred man had paid, was not enough to contain the message. The advertisement was one word too long to fit in the column space available. Unless Löwenthal shuffled around his repeat notices and changed the format of the paper altogether, he would be forced to create what typographers call a widow. That is, the final word of the advertisement, which was Wells, would be marooned at the top of the third column, producing an undesirable and even confusing effect in the reader's mind. By the time Löwenthal discovered this, the scarred man had long since left his office, and Löwenthal was disinclined to venture out into the streets to find him. Instead, he looked for a word to remove, finally deciding to excise the man's middle name, Francis. This omission would prevent the creation of a widow, and the format of his column would not be spoiled. The West Coast Times was published early the following morning, and well before noon the scarred man returned. He insisted, though he did not give a reason, that it was of the utmost importance that his middle name was included. He resented very much that Löwenthal had altered his advertisement without his knowledge, and expressed his displeasure with the same plain-spoken gruffness with which he had first entreated the editor's assistance. Löwenthal, apologizing profusely, printed the notice again, and 5 times after that, for the man had paid for a week's worth of advertising, and Löwenthal thought it prudent, under the circumstances, to offer him a 7th printing for free. Therefore, as Löwenthal explained to Moody, he was certain both of the date of the event and of the man's full name, Crosby Francis Wells. The event stood out in his mind. It is always his first mistake that an entrepreneur remembers. Looking back upon the origins of his enterprise, and the displeasure of a patron is not easily forgotten when one takes one's business to heart. This only left the question of the man's description, for how could Löwenthal be sure that the man in question did in fact possess a scar upon his cheek, as the ex-convict known as Francis Carver certainly did, and as the hermit known as Crosby Wells certainly did not? Upon this final point, Löwenthal conceded that he could not be sure. Perhaps in remembering the event he had overlaid a different memory of a scar-faced man. But he wished to add that his powers of recollection were typically strong, and he could picture this man very vividly in his mind. He remembered that the man had been holding a top hat, and that he had pressed it between his palms as he spoke, as if he meant to compress the thing to a single sheet of felt. This detail surely could not be false. Löwenthal declared that he would be willing to wager a decent sum of money that the man he remembered had indeed possessed a scar, shaped like a sickle, upon his cheek, and that he'd possessed also a birth certificate that bore the name Crosby Francis Wells. Löwenthal did concede, however, that he had never known the hermit Crosby Wells in life, and had no way to imagine his features, because no image or sketch of the dead man had survived him. This new information, as one can well imagine, gave rise to a veritable cacophony of interjection and supposition in the smoking room of the Crown Hotel, and the narrative did not resume for some time. But we shall leave them in the present and bear onward in the past. The ferry service that ran between Canieri and the mouth of the Hokitika River had not been interrupted by the inclement weather, though their custom had slowed. The ferryman, with no one to escort, and no chores outstanding, were sitting about in the open warehouse adjacent to the quay, smoking cigarettes and playing at whist. They looked none too happy to abandon their game and venture out into the rain, and named a fare that reflected this displeasure. Mannering agreed to the sum at once, however, and the ferrymen were obliged to put away their cards, stub out their cigarettes, and set about carrying the boat down the ramp to the water. Canieri was only some 4 miles upriver, a distance that would be covered in no time at all on the return journey, when the oarsmen no longer had to pull against the current. The journey inland, however, could easily take up to an hour, depending on the river's motion, the wind, and the pull of the tide. Diggers travelling back and forth between Canieri and Hokitika usually covered that distance by coach or on foot, but the coach had been and gone already, and the weather disinclined them to walk. Mannering paid the fare, and presently he and Frost were sitting in the stern of a painted dinghy, in fact it was a lifeboat salvaged from a wreck, with the collie dog Holly between them. The stroke-side oarsmen pushed off from the bank with the blades of their oars and pulled strongly. Soon the craft was on her way upstream. Sitting with their backs against the stern, Frost and Mannering found themselves face to face with the oarsmen, rather like a pair of outsized, well-dressed coxswains. The distance between them closed each time the oarsmen leant forward to take another stroke. The two men, therefore, did not speak about the business they were about to perform, for to do so would have been to invite the oarsmen into their confidence. Instead, Mannering kept up a steady flow of chatter about the weather, the Americas, soil, glass, breakfast, sluice mining, native timbers, the Baltic Naval Theatre, and life upon the fields. Frost, who was prone to seasickness, did not move at all, except to reach up periodically and wipe away the drips that formed beneath the brim of his hat. He responded to Mannering's chatter only with clenched noises of agreement,